Mom, my plan is I'll introduce him as Victor Mancini. This way Danny can find out who I really am. This way my mom can find some peace, maybe gain some weight, save me the cost of a stomach tube, not die. When Denny's back from the bathroom, the guard is walking us to the living part of St. Anthony's, and Denny says, "There's no lock on the bathroom door here. I was settled on the can and some old lady just barged in on me." I ask if she wanted sex, and Denny says, "How's that again?" We go through a set of doors the guard has to unlock, then another set. As we walk, his keys bounce against his hip. Even the back of his neck has a big roll of fat. "Your mom," Denny says, "so does she look like you?" "Maybe," I say, "except, you know." And Denny says, "Starved and with no brain left, right?" And I go, "Stop already." I say, "Okay, she was a shitty mom, but she's the only mom I have." "Sorry, dude," Denny says. And he goes, "But won't she notice I'm not you?" Here at St. Anthony's, they have to close the curtains before it gets dark, since if a resident sees themselves reflected in a window, they'll think somebody's peeping in at them. It's called sundowning, when all the old folks get crazy at sunset. You could put most of these folks in front of a mirror and tell them it's a television special about old, dying, miserable people, and they'd watch for hours. The problem is, my mom won't talk to me when I'm Victor, and she won't talk to me when I'm her attorney. My only hope is to be her public defender while Denny's me. I can goad, he can listen, maybe then she'll talk. Think of this as some kind of gestalt ambush. Along the way, the guard asks, "Wasn't I the guy who raped Mrs. Field's dog?" "No," I tell him. "It's a long story," I say, "about 80 years long." We find Mom in the day room, sitting at a table with a shattered jigsaw puzzle spread out in front of her. There must be 1,000 pieces, but there's no box to show how it's supposed to look. It could be anything. Denny says, "That's her?" He says, "Dude, she looks nothing like you." My mom's pushing puzzle pieces around. Some of them turned over so the gray cardboard side shows, and she's trying to fit them together. "Dude," Denny says. He turns a chair around and sits at the table so he can lean forward over the chair's back. "In my experience, these puzzles work best if you find all the flat edge pieces first." My mom's eyes crawl all over Denny, his face, his chapped lips, his shaved head, the holes open in the seams of his T-shirt. "Good morning, Mrs. Mancini," I say. "Your son Victor is here to visit you. This is him." I say, "Don't you have something important to tell him?" "Yeah," Denny says, nodding. "I'm Victor." He starts picking up pieces with a flat edge. "Is this blue part supposed to be sky or water?" he says. And my mom's old blue eyes start to fill up with juice. "Victor," she says. She clears her throat, staring at Denny. She says, "You're here." And Denny keeps spreading the puzzle pieces with his fingers, picking out the flat ones and getting them off to one side. On the stubble of his shaved head, from his red plaid shirt, there are lumps of red lint. And my mom's old hand creaks out across the table and closes around Denny's hand. "It's so good to see you," she says. "How are you? It's been so long." A little eye juice tips out the bottom of one eye and follows the wrinkles to the corner of her mouth. "Geez," Denny says, and he pulls his hand back. "Mrs. Mancini, your hands are freezing." My mom says, "I'm sorry." You can smell some kind of cafeteria food, cabbage or beans, that's being cooked down to mush. This whole time, I'm still standing here. Denny pieces together a few inches of the edge. To me, he says, "So when do we meet this perfect lady doctor of yours?" My mom says, "You're not going already, are you?" She looks at Denny, her eyes swamped, and her old eyebrow bushes kissing together in the middle above her nose. She says, "I've missed you so much." Denny says, "Hey, dude, we lucked out. Here's a corner." My mom's shaky, boiled-looking old hand shakes over and picks a clump of red lint off Denny's head. And I say, "Excuse me, Mrs. Mancini," I say, "but wasn't there something you needed to tell your son?" My mom just looks at me, then at Denny. "Can you stay, Victor?" she says. "We need to talk. There's so much I need to explain." "So explain," I say. Denny says, "Here's an eye, I think." He says, "So is this supposed to be somebody's face?" My mom holds one shaky old hand open at me, and she says, "Fred, this is between my son and me. This is an important family matter. Go someplace. Go watch television and let us visit in private." And I say, but my mom says, "Go." Denny says, "Here's another corner." Denny picks out all the blue pieces and he puts them off to one side. All the pieces are the same basic shape, liquid crosses, melted swastikas. "Go try to save someone else for a change," my mom says. Not looking at me, looking at Denny, she says, "Victor will come find you when we're done." She watches me until I step back as far as the hallway. After that, she says something to Denny I can't hear. Her shaky hand reaches to touch Denny's shiny blue scalp, to touch it just behind one ear. Where her pajama sleeve stops, her old wrist shows stringy and thin brown as a boiled turkey neck. Still nosing around in the puzzle, Denny flinches. A smell comes around me, a diaper smell, and a broken voice behind me says, "You're the one who threw all my second grade primers in the mud." Still watching my mom, trying to see what she's saying, I go, "Yeah, I guess." "Well, here, at least you're honest," the voice says. A dried little mushroom of a woman slips her skeleton's arm through mine. "Come along with me," she says. "Dr. Marshall would like very much to talk to you, alone somewhere." She's wearing Denny's red plaid shirt. Chapter 14. Leaning her head back, her little black brain, Paige Marshall points up into the vaulted beige ceiling. "There used to be angels," she says. "The story is they were incredibly beautiful, with blue feathered wings and real gilded halos." The old woman leads me to the big chapel at St. Anthony's, big and empty since it used to be a convent. One whole wall is a window of stained glass in 100 different colors of gold. The other wall is just a big wood crucifix. Between the two is Paige Marshall in her white lab coat, golden in the gold light, under the black brain of her hair. She's wearing her black glasses and looking up, all of her black and gold. "According to the decrees of Vatican II," she says, "they painted over church murals, the angels and the frescoes. They weeded out most of the statues, all those gorgeous mysteries of faith, all gone." She looks at me. The old woman is gone. The chapel door clicks shut behind me. "It's pathetic," Paige says, "how we can't live with the things we can't understand. How, if we can't explain something, we just deny it." She says, "I found a way to save your mother's life," she says, "but you may not approve." Paige Marshall starts undoing the buttons of her coat, and there's more and more skin showing inside. "You may find the idea entirely repugnant," she says. She opens the lab coat. She's naked inside, naked and as pale white as the skin under her hair, naked white and about 4 steps away, and very doable, and she shrugs a coat off her shoulders so it drapes behind her, still hanging from her elbows, her arms still in the sleeves. "Here are all those tight, furry shadows where you're dying to go. We only had this small window of opportunity," she says. And she steps toward me, still wearing her glasses, her feet still in their white deck shoes. Only they look gold here. I was right about her ears. For sure the resemblance is awesome. Another hole she can't close, hidden and frilled with skin, framed in her soft hair. "If you love your mother," she says, "if you want her to live, you'll need to do this with me." "Now?" "It's my time," she says. "My mucosa is so thick you could stand a spoon in it." "Here?" "I can't see you outside of here," she says. Her ring finger is as bare as most of her. I ask, "Is she married?" "Do you have an issue with that?" she says. Just one reach away is the curve of her waist, going down along the outline of her ass. Just that far is the shelf of each breast, pushing up a dark button nipple. Just my arm away is the warm, hot space where her legs come together. I say, no issues here. Her hands come together around my top shirt button, then the next and the next. Her hands spread the shirt back off my shoulders so it falls behind me. "I just need you to know," I say, "since you're a doctor and everything," I say, "I might be a recovering sex addict." Her hands spring my belt buckle, and she says, then just do what comes naturally. The smell of her skin isn't roses or pine or lemons. It isn't anything, not even skin. How she smells is wet. You don't understand, I say. I have almost 2 whole days of sobriety. The gold light shows her warm and glowy. Still the feeling is, if I kissed her, my lips would stick the way they would on frozen metal. To slow things down, I think of basal cell carcinomas. I picture the bacterial skin infection, impetigo, corneal ulcers. She pulls my face into her ear. Into my ear she whispers, "Fine, that's very noble of you. But how about if you start your recovery tomorrow?" She thumbs my pants off my hips and says, "I need you to put your faith in me." And her smooth, cool hands close around me. Chapter 15. If you're ever in a big hotel lobby and they start to play the Blue Danube waltz, get the hell out. Don't think. Run. Anymore, nothing is straightforward. If you're ever in a hospital and they page Nurse Flamingo to the cancer ward, do not go anywhere near there. There is no Nurse Flamingo. If they page Dr. Blaze, there is no such person. In a big hotel, that waltz means they need to evacuate the building. In most hospitals, Nurse Flamingo means a fire. Dr. Blaze means a fire. Dr. Green means a suicide. Dr. Blue means somebody stopped breathing. This is stuff the mommy told the stupid little boy as they sat in traffic. This is how far back she was going nuts. This one day, the kid had been sitting in class when a lady from the school office had come to tell him his dentist appointment was canceled. A minute later, he raised his hand and asked to go to the bathroom. There never was any appointment. Sure, somebody had called, saying they were from the dentist office, but this was the new secret signal. He went out a side door by the cafeteria, and there she was waiting in a gold car. This was the second time the mommy came back to claim him. She rolled down the window and said, "Do you know why mommy was in jail this time?" "For changing the hair colors," he said. "See also the malicious mischief. See also the second-degree assault." She leaned over to open the door and never stopped talking, not for days and days. "If you're ever in the Hard Rock Cafe," she told him, "and they announce Elvis has left the building, that means all the servers need to go to the kitchen and find out what dinner special has just sold out." These are the things that people tell you when they won't tell you the truth. In a Broadway theater, announcing Elvis has left the building means a fire. In a grocery store, paging Mr. Cash is a call for an armed security guard. Paging freight check to women's clothing means somebody is shoplifting in that department. Other stores page a fake woman named Sheila. Sheila to the front means somebody is shoplifting in the front of the store. Mr. Cash and Sheila and Nurse Flamingo are always bad news. The mommy shut off the engine and sat with one hand gripping the steering wheel at 12 o'clock, and with her other hand she snapped her fingers for the boy to repeat stuff back to her. The insides of her nose were dark with dried blood. Twisted old tissues smeared with more old blood were on the car floor. Some blood was on the dashboard from when she sneezed. On the inside of the windshield was some more. "Nothing you learn in school is this important," she said. "This stuff you're learning here will save your life." She snapped her fingers. "Mr. Almond Silvestri," she said, "if he's paged, what should you do?" At some airports, paging him means a terrorist with a bomb. "Mr. Almond Silvestri, please meet your party at Gate 10 on the D Concourse," means that's where the SWAT team will find their man. "Mrs. Pamela Rank Mensa" means a terrorist in the airport with just a gun. "Mr. Bernard Wellis, please meet your party at Gate 16 on the F Concourse," means someone holding a knife to the throat of a hostage there. The mommy set the parking brake and snapped her fingers again. "Quick, like a bunny," she said. "What's Miss Tara Lynn Mayfield mean?" "Nerve gas," the boy said. The mommy shook her head. "Don't tell me," the boy said. "A rabid dog?" The mommy shook her head. Outside the car, a tight mosaic of traffic was packed around them. Helicopters beat the air above the freeway. The boy tapped his forehead and said, "Flamethrower?" The mommy said, "You're not even trying. Do you want a clue?" drug suspect, he said. Then he said, yeah, maybe a clue. And the mommy said, Miss Tara Lynn Mayfield, now be thinking about cows and horses. And the boy screamed, anthrax. He pounded his forehead with his fists and said, anthrax, anthrax, anthrax. He pounded his head and said, how come I forget so fast? With her free hand, the mommy messed his hair and said, you're doing good. You even remember half of these, and you'll outlive most people. Everywhere they went, the mommy found traffic. She listened for radio bulletins about where not to go and found those tie-ups. She found gridlock. She found traffic jams. She searched for car fires or open drawbridges. She didn't like driving fast, but wanted to look busy. In traffic, she couldn't do anything, and it wasn't her fault. They were trapped, hidden and secure. The mommy said, I'll give you an easy one. She closed her eyes and smiled, then opened them and said, at any store, what's it mean when they ask for quarters on check stand 5? They were both wearing the same clothes from the day she picked him up after school. In whatever motel they got, when he crawled into bed, the mommy snapped her fingers and asked for his pants, his shirt, his socks, his underpants, until he'd passed them all out from under the covers. In the morning when she gave them back, sometimes they were washed. When a cashier asks for quarters, the boy said, they mean a pretty woman standing there and everyone should come look at her. Well, there's more to it than that, the mommy said, but yes. Sometimes the mommy went to sleep against the car door, and all the other cars drove away from around them. If the motor was on, sometimes red dashboard lights the boy didn't even know were there would light up to show all kind of emergencies. These times, smoke came out through the crack around the hood, and the motor stopped by itself. Cars stuck behind them would honk. The radio talked about a new tie-up, a stalled car in the center lane of the freeway blocking traffic. With people honking and looking in the windows at them, being on the radio, the stupid little boy figured this was being famous. Until the car horns woke her up, the little boy just waved. He thought about the fat Tarzan with the monkey and the chestnuts, the way the man could still smile, the way humiliation is humiliation only when you choose to suffer. The little boy smiled back at all the angry faces glaring in at him, and the little boy blew kisses. When a truck honked its horn, then the mommy jumped awake. Then, slow again, she pushed most of the hair off her face for a minute. She pushed a white plastic tube up one nostril and breathed in. Another minute of nothing went by before she took the tube out and squinted at the little boy sitting next to her in the front seat. She squinted at the new red dashboard lights. The tube was smaller than her lipstick, with a hole to smell through at one end and something that stunk inside. After she smelled it, there was always blood on the tube. You're in what, she said, first, second grade? Fifth, the boy said. And at this point, your brain weighs 3-4 pounds, she said. In school, he got straight A's. So that makes you what, she says, 7 years old? 9. Well, Einstein, everything those foster parents of yours have told you, the mommy said, you can forget it. She said, those foster families, they don't know what's important. Right over them was a helicopter flying in one place, and the boy leaned so he could look straight up at it through the blue part at the top of the windshield. The radio talked about a gold Plymouth Duster blocking the center lane of traffic on the beltway. The car appeared to be overheating. Screw history, the mommy said. All these fake people, they're the most important people for you to know. Miss Pepper Haviland is the Ebola virus. Mr. Turner Anderson means somebody just threw up. The radio said emergency crews were being dispatched to help clear the stalled car. All that stuff they're teaching you about algebra and macroeconomics, forget it, she said. You tell me, what does it get you if you can square root a triangle and then some terrorist shoots you in the head? It gets you nothing. This is the real education you need. Other cars edged around them and took off squealing fast and disappeared to other places. I want you to know more than just what people think is safe to tell you, she said. The boy said, like what more? Like when you're thinking about the rest of your life, she said, and she put her hand over her eyes. You're never really thinking about more than a couple years down the road. And what else, she says, is, by the time you're 30, Your worst enemy is yourself. Another thing she said was, the Enlightenment is over. What we're living in now is the disenlightenment. The radio said the police had been notified about the stalled car. The mommy turned up the radio loud. Damn, she said. Please tell me that's not us. It said a gold duster, the boy said. That's our car. And the mommy said, that shows how little you know. She opened her car door and said to slide over and get out on her side. She watched the fast cars just missing driving past them. This isn't our car, she said. The radio yelled how it appeared the occupants were abandoning the vehicle. The mommy shook her hand for him to take. I'm not your mother, she said. It's nothing like that. Under her fingernails was more dried nose blood. The radio yelled after them. The driver of the gold duster and a small child were now a hazard themselves as they were attempting to dodge across four lanes of freeway traffic. She said, I figure we have about 30 days to pile up a lifetime of happy adventures. That's until my credit cards run out. She said, that's 30 days unless we get caught first. Cars honked and swerved. The radio yelled after them. Helicopters roared closer down. And the mommy said, now, just like with the Blue Danube waltz, hold on to my hand tight, she said, and don't think, she said, just run. Chapter 16. The next patient is a female, about 29 years old with a mole on the inside of her thigh that doesn't look right. It's hard to tell in this light, but it looks too big, asymmetrical with shades of blue and brown. The edges are irregular, the skin around it abraded. I ask her if she's been scratching it, and is there any history of skin cancer in her family? Sitting next to me with his yellow legal pad on the table in front of him, Denny's holding one end of a cork over his cigarette lighter, turning the cork until the end is burned black, and Denny says, dude, for serious, he says, you've got some weird hostility tonight. Did you act out? He says, you always hate the whole world after you get laid. The patient falls to her knees spread wide apart. She leans back and starts to pump herself at us in slow motion. Just by contracting her butt muscles, she tosses her shoulders, her breasts, her mons pubis, her entire body lunges at us in waves. The way to remember the symptoms of melanoma is the letters A, B, C, D. Asymmetrical shape, border irregularity, color variation, diameter larger than 6 millimeters. She's shaved, tanned and oiled so smooth and perfect, she looks less like a woman than just another place to swipe your credit card. Pumping herself in our faces, the murky blend of red and black light makes her look better than she really is. The red lights erase scars and bruises, zits, some kind of tattoos, plus stretch marks and track marks. The black lights make her eyes and teeth glow bright white. It's funny how the beauty of art has so much more to do with the frame than with the artwork itself. The light trick makes even Denny look healthy. His chickeny wing arms coming out of his white t-shirt. His legal pad glows bright yellow. He curls his bottom lip inside, biting it as he looks from the patient to his work and back to the patient. Pumping herself in our faces, yelling against the music, she says, what? She looks like a natural blonde, a high risk factor, so I ask, has she had any recent unexplained weight loss? Not looking at me, Denny says, dude, do you know how much a real model would cost me? Back at him, I say, dude, don't forget to sketch her ingrown hairs. To the patient, I ask, has she noticed any changes in her cycle or in her bowel movements? Kneeling in front of us, spreading her black polished fingernails open on either side of herself and leaning back, looking down the arched length of her torso at us, she says, what? Skin cancer, I yell, is the most common cancer in women between the ages of 29 and 34. I yell, I'll need to fill your lymph nodes. And Denny says, dude, you want to know what your mom told me or not? I yell, just let me palpate your spleen. And sketching fast with a burned cork, Denny says, do I sense a shame cycle? The blonde hooks her elbows behind her knees and rolls back onto her spine, twisting a nipple between the thumb and forefinger of each hand. Stretching her mouth wide open, she curls her tongue at us and says, daiquiri. She says, "My name's Cherry Dackery. You can't touch me," she says. "But where's this mole you're talking about?" The way to remember every step in a physical examination is CHAMP FASTS. It's what they call a mnemonic in medical school. The letters stand for chief complaint, history of illness, allergies, medications, past medical history, family history, alcohol, street drugs, tobacco, social history. The only way to get through medical school is mnemonics. The girl before this one, another blonde, but with a kind of hard, old-fashioned boob job you could chin yourself on. This last patient smoked a cigarette as part of her act, so I asked if she had any persistent back or abdominal pain. Had she experienced any loss of appetite, any general malaise? If this was how she made her living, I said, she'd better make sure and get regular smears. If you smoke more than a pack a day, I said, this way I mean. A conization wouldn't be a bad idea, I told her, or at the very least a DNC. She gets down on her hands and knees, rotating her open butt, her puckered pink trap door in slow motion, and looks back over her shoulder at us and says, "What's this conization scene?" She says, "Is this something new you're into?" and exhales smoke in my face. Sort of exhales. "It's when you raise her out, a cone-shaped sample of the cervix," I tell her. And she goes pale, pale even under her makeup, even under the wash of red and black light, and pulls her legs back together. She puts out her cigarette in my beer and says, "You have one sick issue with women," and goes off to the next guy down along the stage. After her, I yell, "Every woman is just a different kind of problem." Still holding his cork, Denny picks up my beer and says, "Dude, waste not." Then pours everything except the drowned butt into his own glass. Denny says, "Your mom talks a lot about some Dr. Marshall. She says he's promised to make her young again." Denny says, "But only if you cooperate." And I say, "She. It's Dr. Paige Marshall. She's a woman." Another patient presents herself, a curly-haired brunette, about 25 years old, exhibiting a possible folic acid deficiency, her tongue red and glazed-looking, her abdomen slightly distended, her eyes glassy. I ask, "Can I listen to her heart? For palpitations, for rapid heartbeat. Has she had any nausea or diarrhea?" "Dude," Denny says. The questions to ask about pain are caldera. Characteristics, onset, location, duration, exacerbation, relief, radiation, and associated symptoms. Denny says, "Dude." The bacteria called Staphylococcus aureus will give you staphio, skin infections, toxic shock syndrome, abscesses, pneumonia, hemolysis, endocarditis, and osteomyelitis. "Dude," Denny says. The diseases a mother can pass to her baby are TORCH, toxoplasmosis, other, meaning syphilis and HIV, rubella, cytomegalovirus, and herpes. It helps if you picture a mother passing the torch to her baby, like mother, like son. Denny snaps his fingers in my face. "What's up with you? How come you're being like this?" he says. "Because it's the truth. This is the world we live in. I've been there, taken the MCAT, the Medical College Admission Test. I went to the USC School of Medicine long enough to know that a mole is never just a mole, that a simple headache means brain tumors, means double vision, numbness, vomiting followed by seizures, drowsiness, death. A little muscle twitch means rabies, means muscle cramps, thirst, confusion, and drooling, followed by seizures, coma, death. Acne means ovarian cysts. Feeling a little tired means tuberculosis. Bloodshot eyes means meningitis. Drowsiness is the first sign of typhoid. Those floaters you see cross your eyes on sunny days, they mean your retina is detaching. You're going blind. See how her fingernails look? I tell Denny, that's a sure sign of lung cancer. If you're confused, that means renal shutdown, severe kidney failure. You learn all this during physical examination, your second year in medical school. You learn all this and there's no going back. Ignorance was bliss. A bruise means cirrhosis of the liver, A belch means colorectal cancer, or esophageal cancer, or at the very least a peptic ulcer. Every little breeze seems to whisper squamous carcinoma. Birds in the trees seem to twitter histoplasmosis. Everybody you see naked, you see as a patient. A dancer could have clear, lovely eyes and hard brown nipples, but if her breath is bad, she has leukemia. A dancer might have thick, long, clean-looking hair, but if she scratches her scalp, she has Hodgkin's lymphoma. Page by page, Denny fills up his pad with figure studies. Beautiful women smiling, thin women blowing him kisses, women with their faces tilted down, but their eyes looking up at him through falls of hair. Losing your sense of taste, I tell Denny, means oral cancers. And without looking at me, looking back and forth between his sketch and the new dancer, Denny says, "Then dude, you got that cancer a long time ago." Even if my mom died, I'm not sure if I'd want to go back and get readmitted before my credits start to expire. As it is, I already know way more than I'm comfortable with. After you find out all the things that can go wrong, your life becomes less about living and more about waiting. For cancer, for dementia. Every look in a mirror you scan for the red rash that means shingles. See also ringworm. See also scabies. See also Lyme disease, meningitis, rheumatic fever, syphilis. The next patient who presents herself is another blonde, thin, maybe a little too thin, a spinal tumor probably. If she has a headache, a low fever, a sore throat, she has polio. "Go like this," Denny yells up at her, and he covers his eyeglasses with his open hands. The patient does this. "Beautiful," Denny says, sketching a fast study. "How about if you open your mouth a little?" And she does. "Dude," he says, "workshop models are never this hot." All I can see is she's not a very good dancer, and for sure this lack of coordination means a myotrophic lateral sclerosis. See also Lou Gehrig's disease. See also total paralysis. See also difficulty breathing. See also cramps, tiredness, crying. See also death. With the edge of his hand, Denny smears the cork lines to add depth and shadow. It's the woman on stage with her hands over her eyes, her mouth slightly open, and Denny picks at it fast, his eyes going back to the woman for details, her belly button, the curve of her hip bones. My only gripe is the way Denny draws women is not the way they look for real. In Denny's version, the cheesy thighs on some woman look rock solid. The bagged-out eyes on some other woman will become clear and toned underneath. "You got any cash left over, dude?" Denny says. "I don't want her to move on just yet." "But I'm broke." And the girl moves on to the next guy down the stage. "Let's see Picasso," I tell him. And Denny scratches under his eye and leaves a big smudge of soot. Then he tips the legal pad enough for me to see a naked woman with her hands over her eyes, sleek and tensing every muscle tight. None of her looks trashed by gravity or ultraviolet light or poor nutrition. She's smooth but soft, flexed but relaxed. She's a total physical impossibility. "Dude," I say, "you made her look too young." The next patient is Cherry Daiquiri again, coming back around, not smiling this time, sucking hard on the inside of one cheek and asking me, "This mole I have, you sure it's cancer? I mean, I don't know, but how scared should I be?" Without looking at her, I hold up one finger. This is international sign language for, "Please wait, the doctor will see you shortly." "No way are her ankles that thin," I tell Denny, "and her ass is way bigger than you have there." I lean over to see what Denny's doing, then look down the stage to the last patient. "You need to make her knees lumpier," I say. The downstage dancer gives me a dirty look. Denny just keeps sketching. He makes her eyes huge. He fixes her split ends. He gets everything all wrong. "Dude," I say, "you know you're not a very good artist." I say, "For serious, dude, I don't see that at all." Denny says, "Before you go trash the whole world, you need to be calling your sponsor bad." He says, "And in case you still give a shit, your mom said you need to read what's in her dictionary." To Cherry crouching there in front of us, I say, "If you're really serious about saving your life, I'm going to have to talk to you someplace private." "No, not dictionary," Denny says. "It's diary. In case you ever wonder where you're really from, it's all in her diary." and Cherry dangles one leg over the edge and starts climbing down from the stage. I ask Denny, what's in my mom's diary? And drawing his little pictures, seeing the impossible, Denny says, yeah, diary, not dictionary, dude. The stuff about your real dad is in her diary. Chapter 17. At St. Anthony's, the front desk girl yawns behind her hand, and when I ask if maybe she wants to go get a cup of coffee, then she looks at me sideways and says, not with you. And really, I'm not hitting on her. I'll watch her desk long enough for her to go get some coffee. This isn't a come-on. Really. I say, your eyes look tired. All she does all day is sign a few people in and out. She watches the video monitor that shows the insides of St. Anthony's, each corridor, the day room, the dining room, the garden, the screen switching from one to the next every 10 seconds, the screen grainy black and white. On the monitor, the dining room shows for 10 seconds, empty with all the chairs upside down on each table, their chrome legs in the air. A long corridor appears for the next 10 seconds with somebody heaped on a bench against one wall. Then for the next 10 furry black and white seconds, there's Paige Marshall, pushing my mom in a wheelchair down some other long corridor. The front desk girl says, I'll only be gone a minute. Next to the video monitor is an old speaker, covered in nubby sofa mohair, is this old radio kind of speaker with a dial switch surrounded by numbers. Each number is some room in St. Anthony's. On the desk is a microphone you can use to make announcements. By turning the dial switch to a number, you can listen in on any room in the building. And just for a moment, my mom's voice comes from the speaker saying, I've defined myself, all my life, by what I was against. The girl switches the intercom dial to 9, and now you can hear Spanish radio and the clatter of metal pans back in the kitchen, back where the coffee is. I tell the girl, take your time, and I'm not the monster you maybe heard from some of the bitter, angry types around here. Even with me being so nice, she puts her purse in her desk and locks it. She says, this won't take me more than a couple of minutes, okay? Okay. Then she's gone through the security doors, and I'm sitting behind her desk, watching the monitor, the day room, the garden, some corridor, each for 10 seconds, watching for Paige Marshall. With one hand, I'm dial switching from number to number, listening in each room for Dr. Marshall, for my mom, in black and white, almost live. Paige Marshall with all her skin. Another question from the sex addict checklist. Do you cut the inside out of your pants pockets so you can masturbate in public? In the day room is some gray head face down in a puzzle. In the speaker, there's just static, white noise. 10 seconds later, in the crafts room is a table of old women, women I confessed to for wrecking their cars, for wrecking their lives, taking the blame. I turn up the volume and put my ear against the cloth of the speaker. Not knowing which number means which room, I dial switch through the numbers and listen. My other hand I slip into what used to be my britches pocket. Going number to number, somebody's sobbing on number 3, wherever that is. Somebody's swearing on 5, praying on 8, wherever that is. The kitchen again on 9, the Spanish music. The monitor shows the library, another corridor. Then it shows me, a grainy black and white me, crouched behind the front desk, peering into the monitor. Me with one hand crabbed around the intercom control dial. My other blurry hand is jammed to the elbow inside my britches, watching. A camera on the lobby ceiling watching me. Me watching for Paige Marshall, listening for where to find her. Stalking isn't the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind. The monitor shows me one old woman after another. Then for 10 seconds, there's Paige pushing my mom in a wheelchair down another corridor. Dr. Paige Marshall. And I dial around until I hear my mom's voice. Yes, she says. I fought against everything. But more and more, I worry that I was never for anything. The monitor shows the garden, old women hunched over walkers, mired in gravel. Oh, my mom says. I can criticize and complain and judge everything, but what does it get me? She keeps saying in voiceover as the monitor cycles to show other rooms. The monitor shows the empty dining room. The monitor shows the garden, more old people. This could be some very depressing website, Death Cam. some kind of black-and-white documentary. Griping isn't the same as creating something, my mom's voiceover says. Rebelling isn't rebuilding. Ridiculing isn't replacing. And the voice in the speaker fades out. The monitor shows the day room, the woman face down in her puzzle. And I dial switch from number to number, searching. On number 5, her voice is back. We've taken the world apart, she says, but we have no idea what to do with the pieces. And her voice is gone again. The monitor shows one empty corridor after another, stretching into darkness. On number 7, the voice comes back. My generation. All of our making fun of things isn't making the world any better, she says. We've spent so much time judging what other people created that we've created very, very little of our own. Out of the speaker, her voice says, I use rebellion as a way to hide out. We use criticism as a fake participation. The voiceover says, it only looks as if we've accomplished something. The voiceover says, I've never contributed anything worthwhile to the world. And for 10 seconds, the monitor shows my mom and Paige in the corridor just outside the crafts room. Out of the speaker, scratchy and far away, Paige's voice says, what about your son? My nose pressed to the monitor, I'm so close. And now the monitor shows me, with my ear pressed to the speaker, one hand shaking something fast inside my pant leg. In voiceover, Paige says, what about Victor? And for serious, I am so ready to trigger. And my mom's voice says, Victor? No doubt Victor has his own way of escaping. Then her voiceover laughs and says, parenthood is the opiate of the masses. And now on the monitor, the front desk girl is standing right behind me with a cup of coffee. Chapter 18. My next visit, my mom's thinner, if that's possible. Her neck looks as small around as my wrist, the yellow skin sunk into deep hollows between her cords and throat. Her face doesn't hide the skull inside. She rolls her head to one side so she can see me in the doorway, and some kind of gray jelly is caked in the corners of each eye. The blankets are slack and tented, empty between the two peaks of her hip bones. The only other landmarks you can recognize are her knees. She twines one terrible arm through the chrome bed rail, terrible and thin as a chicken's foot, reaching toward me, and she swallows. Her jaws work with effort, her lips webbed with spit, and then she says it, reaching out, she says it. Morty, she says, I am not a pimp. Her hands knotted in fists, she shakes them in the air and says, I'm making a feminist statement. How can it be prostitution if all the women were dead? I'm here with a nice bunch of flowers and a get-well card. This is right after work, so I'm in my breeches and waistcoat. My buckle shoes and the clock stockings that show off my skinny calves are spattered with mud. And my mom says, Morty, you have to get the whole case thrown out of court. And she sighs back into her stack of pillows. Drool from her mouth has turned the white pillowcase light blue where it meets the side of her face. A get-well card is not going to fix this. Her hand claws the air and she says, Oh, and Morty, you need to call Victor. Her room has that smell, the same smell as Denny's tennis shoes in September after he's worn them all summer without socks. A nice bunch of flowers won't make a dent. In my waistcoat pocket is her diary. Stuck in the diary is a past due bill from the care center. I stick the flowers in her bedpan while I go to hunt for a vase and maybe something to feed her. As much of that chocolate pudding stuff as I can carry, something I can spoon into her mouth and make her swallow. The way she looks, I can't bear to be here, and I can't bear not to be here. As I leave, she says, you've got to get busy and find Victor. You have to make him help Dr. Marshall. Please, he has to help Dr. Marshall save me. As if anything ever happens by accident. Outside in the hallway is Paige Marshall, wearing her glasses, reading something off a clipboard. I just thought you'd like to know, she says. She leans back against the handrail that lines the hallway and says, your mother is down to 85 pounds this week. She moves the clipboard behind her back, gripping it and the handrail with both hands. The way she stands, puts her breasts forward, tilts her pelvis at me. Paige Marshall runs her tongue along the inside of her bottom lip and says, have you thought any more about taking some action? Life support, tube feeding, artificial respirators. In medicine they call this stuff heroic measures. I don't know, I say. We stand there, waiting for each other to give an inch. Two smiling old ladies wander past us, and one points and says to the other, "There's that nice young man I told you about. He's the one who strangled my pet cat." The other lady, her sweater is buttoned wrong, and she says, "You don't say." She says, "He beat my sister almost to death one time." They wander away. "It's sweet," Dr. Marshall says. "What you're doing, I mean. You're giving these people completion on the biggest issues in their lives. The way she looks right now, you have to think about multiple car pileups. Imagine two bloodmobiles colliding head-on. The way she looks, you'd have to think of mass graves to even log 30 seconds in the saddle. Think of spoiled cat food and ulcerated cankers and expired donor organs. That's how beautiful she looks. If she'll excuse me, I still need to find some pudding." She says, "Is it that you have a girlfriend? Is that the reason? The reason why we didn't have sex in the chapel a few days ago? The reason why, even with her naked and ready, I couldn't? The reason why I ran?" For a complete listing of other girlfriends, please refer to my fourth step. See also Nico. See also Lisa. See also Tanya. Dr. Marshall tilts her pelvis at me and says, "Do you know how most patients like your mother die? They starve. They forget how to swallow and breathe food and drink into their lungs by accident. Their lungs fill with rotting matter and liquid, and they develop pneumonia and they die." I say I know. I say maybe there's worse things you can do than just letting somebody old die. "This isn't just some old person," Paige Marshall says. "This is your mother. And she's almost 70 years old." "She's 62, Paige says. "If there's anything you can do to save her and you don't, you're killing her with neglect." In other words, I say, I should do you. "I've heard about your track record from some of the nurses," Paige Marshall says. "I know you have no issues around recreational sex. Or is it just me? Am I not your type? Is that it?" The two of us get quiet. A certified nurse's aide walks past, pushing a cart of bundled sheets and damp towels. Her shoes have rubber soles, and the cart has rubber wheels. The floor is ancient cork tile polished dark with traffic. So she goes by without a sound, just the stale, trailing urine smell. "Don't get me wrong," I say. "I want to fuck you. I really want to fuck you." Down the hall, the nurse's aide stops and looks back at us. She says, "Hey, Romeo, why don't you give poor Dr. Marshall a break?" Paige says, "It's fine, Miss Parks. This is between Mr. Mancini and myself." We both stare back until she smirks and pushes her cart off around the next corner. Her name's Irene Parks, and yeah, okay, we did it in her car in the parking lot about this time last year. See also Karen, RN. See also Janine, CNA. At the time, I thought each of them was going to be somebody special, but without their clothes on, they could have been anybody. Now her ass is about as inviting as a pencil sharpener. To Dr. Paige Marshall, I say, "There you are, so wrong." I say, "I want to fuck you so bad I can taste it." I say, "And no, I don't want anybody to die, but I don't want my mom back the way she's always been." Paige Marshall exhales. She sucks her mouth into a tight little knot and just glares at me. She holds her clipboard to her chest with her arms crossed over it. "So," she says, "this hasn't anything to do with sex. You just don't want your mother to recover. You just can't deal with strong women, and you think that if she dies, then your issue about her will also." From her room, my mom calls, "Morty, what am I paying you for?" Paige Marshall says, "You can lie to my patients and complete their life conflicts, but don't lie to yourself." Then she says, "And don't lie to me." Paige Marshall says, "You'd rather see your mother dead than see her recover." And I say, "Yes, I mean, no, I mean, I don't know." All my life, I've been less my mother's child than her hostage, the subject of her social and political experiments, her own private lab rat. Now she's mine, and she's not going to escape by dying or by getting better. I just want one person I can rescue. I want one person who needs me, who can't live without me. I want to be a hero, but not just one time. Even if it means keeping her crippled, I want to be someone's constant savior. I know this sounds terrible, I say, but I don't know. This is what I think. Here's where I should tell Paige Marshall what I really think. I mean, I'm just tired of being wrong all the time just because I'm a guy. I mean, how many times can everybody tell you you're the oppressive, prejudiced enemy before you give up and become the enemy? I mean, a male chauvinist pig isn't born, he's made, and more of them are being made by women. After long enough, you just roll over and accept the fact that you're a sexist, bigoted, insensitive, crude, cretinist cretin. Women are right, you're wrong. You get used to the idea, you live down to expectations. Even if the shoe doesn't fit, you'll shrink into it. I mean, in a world without God, aren't mothers the new God? The last sacred, unassailable position? Isn't motherhood the last perfect magical miracle, but a miracle that's impossible for men? And maybe men say they're glad not to give birth, all the pain and blood, but really that's just so much sour grapes. For sure, men can't do anything near as incredible. Upper body strength, abstract thought, phalluses, any advantages men appear to have are pretty token. You can't even hammer a nail with a phallus. Women are already born so far ahead, ability-wise. The day men can give birth, that's when we should start talking about equal rights. I don't tell Paige all that. Instead, I say how I just want to be one person's guardian angel. Revenge isn't the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind. Then save her by fucking me, says Dr. Marshall. But I don't want her saved all the way, I say. I'm terrified of losing her, but if I don't, I may lose myself. There's still my mother's red diary in my coat pocket. There's still the chocolate pudding to get. You don't want her to die, Paige says, and you don't want her to recover. Just what do you want? I want somebody who can read Italian, I say. Paige says, like what? Here, I say, and show her the diary. It's my mom's. It's in Italian. Paige takes the book and leafs through it. Her ears look red and excited around the edge. I took 4 years of Italian as an undergrad, she says. I can tell you what it says. I just want to keep control, I say. For a change, I want to be the adult. Still leafing through the book, Dr. Paige Marshall says, you want to keep her weak, so you're always the one in charge. She looks up at me and says, it sounds as if you'd like to be God. Chapter 19. Black and white chickens stagger around Colonial Dunsborough. Chickens with their heads flattened. Here are chickens with no wings and only one leg. There are chickens with no legs, swimming with just their ragged wings through the barnyard mud. Blind chickens without eyes, without beaks, born that way, defective, born with their little chicken brains already scrambled. There's the invisible line between science and sadism, but here it's made visible. It's not that my brains are going to fare much better. Just look at my mom. Dr. Paige Marshall should see them all struggle along, not that she'd understand. Denny here with me. Denny reaches into the back of his pants and pulls out a page of the classified ads from the newspaper, all folded up in a little square. For sure this is contraband. His Royal High Governorship sees this, and Denny's going to be banished to unemployment. For real. Right out in the barnyard in front of the cowshed, Denny hands me this newspaper page. Except for the newspaper, we're being so authentic. It's like nothing we're wearing's even been washed in this century. People are snapping pictures, trying to take part of you home as a souvenir. People point video cameras trying to trap you into their vacation. They're all shooting you, shooting the crippled chickens. Everybody's trying to make every minute of the present last forever. Preserve every second. Inside the cowshed, there's the gurgle of somebody sucking air through a bong. You can't see it, but there's that silent tension of a bunch of people leaned together in a circle trying to hold their breath. A girl coughs. Ursula, the milkmaid. There's so much reefer in there, a cow coughs. This is when we're supposed to be harvesting dried cow things, you know, cow piles. And Denny goes, read it, dude, the circled ad. He opens the page for me to see. That ad there, he says. There's one little classified circled in red ink. With a milkmaid around, the tourists, there's nothing less than a trillion ways we can get caught. For real, Denny could not be more obvious. Against my hand, the paper's still warm from Denny's butt, and when I go, not here, dude, and try to give the paper back. When I do that, Denny says, sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, incriminate you. If you want, I can just read it to you. the grade schoolers who come here. It's a big deal for them to visit the hen house and watch the eggs hatch. Still, a regular chick isn't as interesting as, say, a chicken with only one eye, or a chicken with no neck, or with a stunted, paralyzed leg. So the kids shake the eggs, shake them hard, and put them back to hatch. So what if what's born is deformed or insane? It's all for the sake of education. The lucky ones are just born dead. Curiosity or cruelty? For sure, me and Dr. Marshall would go around and around on this point. I shovel up some cow pies, careful so they don't break in half, so the wet insides don't stink. With all the cow crap on my hands, I have to not bite my nails. Next to me, Denny reads, "Free, to good home, 23-year-old male, recovering self-abuser, limited income and social skills, house-trained." Then he reads a phone number. It's his phone number. "It's my folks, dude. That's their phone number," Denny says. It's like they're hinting. "He found this left on his bed last night." Denny says, "They mean me." I say I understand that part. With a wood shovel, I'm still getting the poops, piling them in a big woven thing, you know, a basket thing. Denny says, "Can he come live with me?" "We're talking Plan Z here," Denny says. "I'm only asking you as a last resort." Because he doesn't want to bug me, or because he's not nuts about living with me, I don't ask. You can smell corn chips on Denny's breath. Another violation of historic character. He's such a shit magnet. The milkmaid, Ursula, comes out of the cow shed and looks at us with her stoner eyes just about filled with blood. "If there was a girl you liked," I say to Denny, "if she wanted to just have sex so she could get pregnant, would you?" Ursula grabs her skirts up and comes stomping through the cow poop in her wooden clogs. She kicks a blind chicken that's in her way. Somebody snaps her picture, kicking. A married couple start to ask Ursula to hold their baby for a picture, but then maybe they see her eyes. "I don't know," Denny says. "A baby's not like having a dog. I mean, a baby lives a long time, dude." "But what if she wasn't planning to have the baby?" I say. Denny's eyes go up and then down, looking at nothing. Then he's looking at me. "I don't understand," he says. "You mean like sell it?" "I mean like sacrifice it," I say. And Denny says, "Dude." "Just supposing," I say, "she's going to scramble its little unborn fetus brain and suck the mess out with a big needle and then inject the stuff into the head of somebody you know who has brain damage to cure them," I say. Denny's lips hang open a crack. "Dude, you don't mean me, do you?" "I mean my mom. It's called a neural transplant. Some people call it a neural graft. It's the only effective way to rebuild my mom's brain at this late stage. It would be better known except for the problems associated with getting the key ingredient." "A ground-up baby," Denny says. I say a fetus. "Fetal tissue," Paige Marshall said. Dr. Marshall with her skin and her mouth. Ursula stops next to us, and she points at the newspaper in Denny's hand. She says, "Unless the date on that 1734, you're fucked. That's a violation of character." The hair on Denny's head is trying to grow back, except some is ingrown and trapped under red or white pimples. Ursula steps away, then turns back. "Victor," she says, "if you need me, I'll be churning." I say, "Later," and she slogs off. Denny says, "Dude, so it's like a choice between your mom and your firstborn?" "It's not a big deal the way Dr. Marshall sees it. We do it every day, kill the unborn to save the elderly." In the gold wash of the chapel, breathing her reasons into my ear, she asked, "Every time we burn a gallon of gas or an acre of rainforest, aren't we killing the future to preserve the present? The whole pyramid scheme of Social Security." She said, with her breasts wedged between us, she said, "I'm doing this because I care about your mother. The least you could do is your own small part." I didn't ask what she meant by small part. And Denny says, "So tell me the truth about yourself." "I don't know. I couldn't go through with it, with a fucking part." "No," Denny says, "I mean, did you read your mom's diary yet?" "No, I can't. I'm a little stuck around this dicey baby-killing issue." Denny looks me hard in the eye and says, "Are you really like a cyborg? Is that your mom's big secret?" "A what?" I say. "You know," he says, "an artificial humanoid created with a limited lifespan, but implanted with false childhood memories, so you think you're really a real person, except you're really going to die soon." And I look at Denny hard and say, "So dude, my mom told you I'm some kind of robot? Is that what her diary says?" Denny says. Two women come up, holding a camera, and one says, "Do you mind?" "Say cheese," I tell them.